This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take. A lot going on in our world, and especially when it comes to crypto. And you were just drawing my attention, Tim, to the latest story when it comes to Sam Bankman-Fried, of course, the former FTX CEO, saying he was mistaken about the cryptocurrencies exchange's leverage levels, thinking it was about $5 billion when it was $13 billion. And he's putting this out in a series of tweets.
Yeah, 23 tweets. He said $13 billion in leverage, total run on the bank, total collapse in asset value all at once, which is why you don't want leverage.
All right, so let's get into it because
those are his words.
Yeah, those are his words. Good point. The cover story of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, which is out on newsstands tomorrow, already on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com, looks into FTX, its undoing, how it delivered a lot of shocks, but perhaps most of all, the shock of what we didn't know, which is kind of interesting to hear what SBF maybe didn't know either about leverage at his own firm. Let's get to it. Bloomberg News crypto reporter Olga Karif has been following this. Her reporting on FTX and crypto has been a must read. She joins us via Zoom from Portland, Oregon. Olga, good to have you here with Tim and myself. So tell us about your story and what you looked into.
Thank you. It's great to be here. So essentially, we looked at sort of what happened, what are the ramifications for the crypto industry. And this has been, of course, a huge shock for everybody who's been in the crypto community for a long time, and as well as newer investors who came in the last couple of years. You know, it's a complete shock because Sam Bankman-Fried, or SBF as he was known, he was sort of considered to be one of the most sort of trustworthy, if you will, people in crypto. He was testifying in Congress. He was meeting with regulators. He had a lot of respect and a lot of weight in this industry. And all of a sudden, his company has come undone.
Yeah, a lot of respect and a lot of influence. Magazine covers, as even he alluded to, he said he became overconfident as a result of that. Hey, Olga, one thing that I'm having a really hard time reconciling is, you know, the prominent backers of the company and the really sloppy leaked balance sheet that we saw. I mean, how does a company this big have such a lack of understanding of what it has on the balance sheet? And we're seeing that play out in real time with Sam Bankman-Fried's tweets. Like, he's saying these are all rough. And he said he didn't know how much leverage he had.
Yeah, you know, it's incredibly surprising. And I think what this means is that there wasn't enough oversight. There wasn't enough due diligence that you need for a company this size with such a caliber of investors. Typically, for a company this size, you would have a board and you would have all kinds of, you know, auditing going on and committees and, you know, plenty of people will be looking through what's going on. And what we find is that for FTX, a lot of it has been just, Sam Bankman-Fried overseeing the entire operation.
You know, it's interesting, you know, you note too some of the other tweets that Sam Bankman-Fried has done and talked about how he messed up different words that he used and blaming poor internal labeling of accounts. this is not someone who doesn't understand, right, how the sophisticated financial system works. If you look about his past experience, right, this is someone who should have known, or do we give him some room for not having better systems in place? How are we supposed to look at this?
So on the one hand, he is only 30 years old. So, but on the other hand, during this 30 years, he has managed to do a lot. He was a trader at Jane Street, of course, the very highly respected quantitative trading firm, which gave him Wall Street cred. And then he also ran Alameda since 2017. Alameda Research was his trading firm. Initially, he Alameda essentially made money off of price differences on different crypto exchanges and made quite a lot of money that way. And then he branched out into actually running a crypto exchange in 2019. And so he had a lot of experience, I would think, with financial matters. So even though he's quite young, but he has had a few years when he should have learned how to run things properly.
So what repercussions could he face? He does keep tweeting over and over again that his number one priority is making it right with customers. We'll see if he's able to do that. But what consequences could he face?
So in terms of his tweets, they're getting a huge backlash online because people don't trust him anymore, and essentially just almost wish that he didn't even say anything, because instead of this empty promises. In terms of what could happen to him, it's still unclear. FTX is still in the process of filing it's a bankruptcy, all of its requisite sort of initial bankruptcy documents. I'm sure there will be an analysis of what exactly went wrong and who's to blame. Nobody has been charged with anything yet. So I think it's going to be a pretty long and drawn out process. We'll have to see how it plays out. But a lot of people are kind of convinced that somebody, could face charges for this.
Well, Olga, it almost feels like an uber case of FOMO, right? As soon as he got momentum and, media coverage, created some of that momentum. You had certain venture capitalists or Silicon Valley investors getting in. And I'm sure friends were talking about, like, hey, what are you guys on to? Like, it's just, you think about how the momentum and velocity that was created by SBF. I'm not, behind him for a lot of different reasons, and big name investors wanting to get in because, some other big name investors were in and not giving him a pass, but you realize this can happen, when there are frenetic investments that are out there.
Absolutely. I think we sort of until this year, we were in this raging crypto bull market where, prices were going up like crazy. Everybody, all of the venture capitalists wanted to find the next unicorn in crypto. When they saw, this very respected investors like Sequoia, backing FTX, perhaps some of them haven't done as much due diligence, it sounds like, as they should have, just to check things out. There are sort of standard processes for due diligence in any industry, but I think some of them may have been forgotten in the rush to get in.
Yes or no, Olga, we have 10 seconds. Is this the end of crypto as we know it?
I don't think so. I think it's going to come out of it, but it's going to be a long lull while investors lick their wounds and sort of crypto prices start moving up again, and everybody becomes invested in crypto again.
Those wounds are deep. Olga Karif of Bloomberg News. This is the cover story of the magazine.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The last few years have reminded us of how the world as we know it can be turned upside down thanks to the global pandemic, the pushback against globalization, and rising and unexpected geopolitical tensions. While this is all happening, of course, as G20 leaders have been meeting in Bali, Indonesia, with all of that in mind, we welcome former U.S. Secretary of Commerce Carlos Gutierrez, served under President George W. Bush. He is co-founder and executive chairman of Empath. It's a company that works with other companies and their HR teams really on identifying the skills of its workers, tapping into that talent to the benefit of both employee and employer. And he joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Mr. Secretary, so delighted to have you here with us. I do want to ask you and start with the G20. Do you think it was a productive round of meetings? If so, or if not, if you could explain.
Well, I never expect a lot from those meetings. The statements are usually what you get. But very rarely do you get any concrete decisions. One thing that the G20 did do is issue a statement against the war in Ukraine, although it wasn't really unanimous. There were a couple of there was language that tended to soften the demand, let's say. On the trade side, I found their statement to be very bland, very non-committal. They talk about trade, but they talked about trade in relation to sustainability. So anytime you see the word trade, you usually see sustainability. Nothing about tariffs, nothing about protectionism, really nothing about globalization. So it was a very weak endorsement of trade. I agree that WTO needs reform, and that goes ahead. I wish we had a reformed and strengthened WTO when all the tariffs started, but it seems to me like it's going to continue to be the status quo.
How would you have advised the Biden administration to go into this G20 with the results that you were looking for?
Yeah, I would, especially now that that the midterms are over, I would have leaned forward a lot more on the importance of trade. Maybe the administration tried to get a statement in there about trade and intellectual property and technology, but probably could not get the whole group to go with it. But the administration has really left some big value on the table. For example, the CTPP. A trade agreement which will bring or open up a lot of countries in Asia for U.S. manufacturers, U.S. companies. That was an Obama-era agreement, and nothing has happened. I would have thought that President Trump took it out because he was following protectionist policies, and I would have expected President Biden to come back in because it's for the good of the U.S. It's actually hard to explain because we're giving Asia essentially to China. They have RCEP, which would unify Asia under one agreement, and the U.S. won't be part of it. So I think what's happening is that domestic politics are overshadowing and taking over any foreign policy. But you rarely hear any foreign policy strategy, any doctrine of sorts. It really is behaving on the basis of what works domestically.
Mr. Secretary, it does feel like we've seen a lot of nations looking inward, and maybe that's the result of the pandemic, or they had to take care of their own, even though it was a global pandemic. Do you believe the era of globalization, the era of global supply chains, on a day when we see Apple getting ready to begin outsourcing chips for its devices from a plant here in Arizona, which would be a big pivot from them away from Asia back here home? Do you feel like globalization and global supply chains, that era is over?
Well, there's no question that it's taken a pause. And how long that pause will last is really something to see. But companies who bring manufacturing back, while that's very welcome from a standpoint of jobs, it does raise the cost. So at some point, they're going to have to address that. We'll always have lower cost foreign competition. So yes, bringing manufacturing back is a great idea domestically. But it is going to increase the cost. Mm-hmm. Different supply chains, longer supply chains, or even supply chains closer by that are not as efficient as they were, will also impact costs. So I think it's really interesting right now, and this is just anecdotally, but I am seeing more out of stocks than I remember seeing any time during COVID. Hmm. And that what that tells me is that
what are you seeing those out of stocks in? Where are you seeing that? What are you seeing?
I'm seeing them at pharmacies, and I'm seeing at grocery stores.
Yeah,
basically the two places where I go, and it's incredible. It's just hard to find things, and the out of stocks go on for a week or two, and that just means that the new supply chains or whatever supply chains are being constructed aren't working.
Right.
We're not getting the right product to the right place at the right time.
Kind of interesting, right? Certainly fascinating in terms of what you're seeing and your thoughts on this, the big picture. Thank you so much. Carlos Gutierrez, former U.S. Secretary of Commerce under President George W. Bush. He's co-founder and executive chairman of Empath, joining us on the phone from D.C. You're listening and watching Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Your next guest knows a lot about getting packages shipped, especially when it comes to the e-commerce world. So delighted to get to our next guest.
We've got Lauren Behrens Wu, co-founder and CEO of Shippo. She joins us via Zoom from the San Francisco Bay Area. Laura, great to chat with you once again. So you've got tons of thousands of businesses that Shippo serves. You work to use software to get them the best deals on their shipping. Give us an idea. I want to talk about business in a second, but just give us an idea of what you're seeing when it comes to the economy out there, because we're getting mixed reports from some of the biggest retailers out there.
Yeah, it's great to be on Bloomberg Radio today. Thanks for having me. And then just to kind of set the stage around what we do here at Shippo. So we're a software platform that connects e-commerce companies to a network of different shipping providers. So all of our customers, they need to ship. They're selling products on the internet, and they need to move their products from A to B to the customers. And we're building that software component there. The carriers are doing the heavy lifting, they're doing the shipping, and we're building the technology, giving access to discounted shipping rates, and just helping SMBs ship like retail giants. And now to your question around what we're seeing, it is a difficult prediction for this holiday season. I think what's for sure happening is that in previous years, we've seen that there was a big spike around the big deal days like Black Friday and Cyber Monday. And we're seeing that change. We're seeing elevated shipping and elevated discounts just way earlier in the season, which is a very interesting trend.
Interesting.
We don't think that there will be as big of a spike on these two big normal deal days, but those deals are happening much earlier in the season nowadays. And customers or consumers are getting access to discounted products earlier on.
I was going to say, Laura, I mean, I had to pick up something for my daughter and she's like, hey, mom, there's already a Black Friday sale, so you can get it now. Yeah. So it's definitely happened. Having said that, I do like talking to folks like you because you do have a great indication of what's going on in the macro environment. What you are seeing in terms of activity and the upcoming holidays, does it speak recession to you?
So we're for sure looking at a much softer Q4 compared to previous Q4s. But previous Q4s were out of the ordinary as well, with pandemic limiting us from like going to physical stores. So this year we're seeing a little bit of back to the previous trend lines.
And then, so 2019 kind of, or below 2019?
2019 kind of. That is what we're expecting. Also because consumers still have a lot of, like, the job market is still going strong. Consumer spending is still doing okay. But it's very hard to predict. I think we're like next year, we're for sure looking at a recession year. And we're thinking that this holiday season will still be a good year for, or good season for retailers.
Remind us too, you talked about the business, and we appreciate you reminding our audience about what it is exactly that you guys do, but you do play into the e-commerce sector. I mean, who is your typical customer?
Yeah, our typical customer is an SMB merchant. So merchants that are selling things on the internet.
What's SMB?
SMB is between 500 and 5,000 packages a month. So it's a pretty wide range here. But our typical customer ships anything from fashion to makeup, anything you can buy on the internet. And we've actually seen an explosion in the SMB segment during the pandemic, like more businesses getting started, more businesses moving online. So that's the perfect audience for us. And we're not enterprise. So Amazon and Target and Walmart are out of scope for us. But at, like, the smaller mid-market, SMB and mid-market segment, that's our customer.
What makes you so confident that we're going to see a recession next year? What's the data that you can point to that indicates that?
Yeah, it looks like all indicators, the tech market is softening. We're seeing rounds of layoffs in the tech industry that will affect other industries later on as well. And I think that is just causing the negative spiral there to consumer spending being worse. And people are not willing to spend on discretionary products. Inflation is at a record high, and we've seen the gas prices rising. So all indications lead to a recession year next year. But I'm not an economist, so fingers crossed that I'm wrong.
All right. Yeah. Well, no, but you have a great, view and vantage point when it comes to, especially when it comes to small and medium businesses, which is so much the backbone of the U.S. economy. Laura, thank you so much. Great to spend some time with you. Laura Behrens-Wu, co-founder, CEO of Shippo, joining us via Zoom from the San Francisco Bay Area.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just got about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. It's been a little bit of a torture trade, if you will. Little change, though, but mostly it's the technology names, as we heard from Charlie, under pressure today. Just a reminder, NASDAQ down about 1.1%. almost 1.4%. S&P, though, just down about 0.6%, and call it flat, slightly higher than the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Yeah, but follows a couple days of gains for the major averages, and a great week last week. And that's what I want to talk to Emily Hill about. She's founding partner at Bowersock Capital Partners. They've got about $800 million in assets under management. Emily joins us on the phone from Lawrence, Kansas. Emily, how are you?
Oh, how are you?
It's good to have you back with us. Hey, we're grateful for the notes that you sent to our producer, Paul Brennan. And I'm seeing that you're saying that we're in a bear market rally right now. What makes you say that?
Well, I think I'm not alone in suspecting that this is a bear market rally. You know, I think this is very similar. It's a redo of what we saw in July. There's still so much liquidity in the market that, you know, people are looking for any kind of signal from the Fed that can be that can lead to optimism. So I think what we're going to see is in the first quarter a revisiting of the lows we saw in June and again in October. And I think the primary driver for that will be the fourth quarter earnings reporting season. It just takes time for higher interest rates, strong dollar, tight labor market to feed through into earnings. And I don't think we saw the full impact of that in the third quarter. Earnings were really a mixed bag. But I think this rally is overdone. And again, I don't think I'm alone in believing that. And in fact, the one thing that gives me pause is that I'm so positive that it's a bear market rally that I must be wrong.
Too much conviction.
I'm rarely this positive of anything.
So. It does feel like sometimes there's some significant swings, Emily, in terms of sentiment. You know, when things are going bad, it does feel like everybody kind of overdoes it to the downside. And then all of a sudden, wait, everything's okay. And we're rallying, you know, like everyone said this was going to be a volatile year. I think that's about the one thing we could count on here in 2022.
Well, I agree. And I think people have to remember that this is still a liquidity-driven market and has been for years. And normalizing this market is going to be a lengthy process. So every optimism-driven rally that we have like this delays the normalization process. This is not what this is the last thing the Fed wants, is these bursts of euphoria. So, you know,
you're taking me back to the spring when Jay Powell just came out and crushed the rally. Like, do you think he's going to do that again?
Well, I listened to the same, you're probably talking about, I think it was July, when there was just this huge rally based on what Chairman Powell said in the meeting. And I listened to the exact same conversation and did not see any optimism in that speech. So my team laughed about it. We're an all-female team, and we call it the testosterone-driven rally. I mean, I don't know where they were getting reasons for optimism in what he said.
Well, I know, you know, and I do wonder too, Emily, I mean, we can go all macro here, and I feel like on any given day, we can make a different macro story sometimes based on the economic data points or what Fed officials are saying. But when it comes to, you know, the bottom line, I mean, you have to put money to work for your investors. So how do you do it in this environment? Where do you do it?
That's a very good question. For people who have had liquidity events in the last year and have substantial amounts of cash, and I do have a number of investors like that, I think it's important to start putting money gradually to work now. Because as I said, I could be wrong. And there's so much happening globally. You know, all it would take would be some kind of resolution to the Russian-Ukraine conflict or all sorts of things out of our control that could really turn this around. So it is important to keep putting money to work. And if you're a long-term strategic investor, stay invested. But we are leaning more into cash equivalents. You know, I know they're not very exciting, but T-bills yielding almost 4.5% maturing next May. This is a really good time, frankly. We haven't seen yields like that in T-bills in years, and there are worse places to be than that. You know, I think we're in a U-shaped downturn here, and I think it's probably going to be into, you know, the second half of next year before we pull out of this. So that's a good place to park cash in the meantime.
But you're not, is there an equity play here?
You know, I do like small cap stocks.
Okay.
Small cap stocks are trading.
You always like small caps. I say that with respect.
Pardon me?
Yeah, you've liked small caps when you've been on with us before. Is that really kind of your sweet spot?
Well, right now, small cap is trading at a bigger discount to large cap stocks than they have been since the early 2000s. Mm. So just on a relative value basis, they're significantly more attractive. So, you know, does that mean that they're going to, you know, that they're going to pay off in 3 months or 5 months? You know, no. But in terms of long-term investors, this is a really good time to invest in small cap.
When you say,
I also think.
Oh yeah, go ahead. Sorry, Emily.
Yeah, we also like some international markets, but we definitely hedge our currency exposure because I think we're likely to continue to have a strong dollar. Hmm.
Emily, before we let you go, you said gradual. If some of your clients have cash positions right now to start deploying them into the market, what do you mean by gradual? Like, how should they be dollar cost averaging?
Well, we have a long-term, we will set a plan, and it may be, in this case, we're using a lot of nine to 12 month plans, where we have a long-term strategic asset allocation strategy, and we're investing a certain amount per month, but we also have triggers. And what I mean by that is, you know, if the market drops beyond something we expect, then we're going to accelerate that. So, it's a little bit of rigorous entry strategy combined with, you know, some tactical maneuvering.
All right. We're going to leave it on that note. Hey, Emily, thank you so much for joining us on this Wednesday. Emily Hill, she is founding partner at Bowersock Capital Partners. They've got $800 million in assets under management. Joining us on the phone from Lawrence, Kansas. So interesting. I have to say, Tim, it does feel like there's some momentum about concerns about 2023, certainly at least early in the year. I think about what Emily was saying. I think about the company that we talked with, Shippo, the CEO, concerns talking about recession. It does feel like the conversation is shifting a little bit.
Yeah, but as Katie Greifeld has said, like, you know, are we going to talk ourselves into a recession?
We could. Sentiment can be pretty powerful if everybody steps back. But if you're losing a job and you're not making money, you don't have a choice. Talk yourself into it. You just don't have the money.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us live on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.